Thank you. Thanks everybody for coming. We're starting a little bit late deliberately because we had a commission meeting before and I wanted to give everybody the opportunity to be here with us. I am very happy to welcome David Lansing here in Frankfurt. David, who is at the moment Professor Economic Geographer at the University of Maryland, which is something like 50 kilometers in north of Washington. And David came really over to Frankfurt, especially for this talk this afternoon. I personally remember quite well when I met David the first time. That was 5 years ago in 2008 when we were organizing together with Mark Böckler and Christian Berndt a workshop on performing markets. And for this workshop we had invited some of the usual suspects, big names in economic geography, also in economic sociology. But we were also looking for younger scholars working using performativity approaches for their work and being at the moment involved in some more empirical project. And one of the really first names we came across was David's name. I think at that time, you finished your PhD in 2010 or 2009?
2009.
So yeah, we invited David to this workshop. And one thing I remember quite well too from his presentation, that David was able to shock everybody because he started his talk by calculating his own personal carbon emissions he had caused just by traveling from the United States to this remote castle in Bavaria. This is one thing I remember quite well. That was only calculation of his personal carbon emissions, but the talk he gave in Hirschberg at that time was also about calculation. And the problem of calculation is something I think which runs like a red thread through the work and through David's publications of the last years. A revised version of this talk he gave in 2008 came out in 2010 in Environment and Planning D, I think. And since then he has published several papers all around the topic of calculation, but what I really liked with his publications, he always put it in different contexts. So it was calculation in the context of taming nature, commodifying nature, juxtaposing it to Marxist approaches. It was the problem of calculation in a much broader, nearly ontological sense, calculation as a way of ordering the world. It was, of course, calculation in terms of making markets. And in a recent paper for which he received the Ashby Prize for the journal Environment and Planning A this year, it was calculation in the context of agency. So I think this more or less gives you a rough impression what David is working on. You all have read at least one or two papers he had written in the last time, and I think you all have all received in your seminars some more information about David. So I want to stop here and just say you thank you again for coming, and the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you. Thank you
very much for that gracious introduction. Yes, it's true, in 2008, I was a graduate student in the field, and I received this somewhat shocking email, being invited all the way to Germany to go to this workshop on performing markets. They had a list of people they invited, and it was all these very famous people, so it was quite exciting at the time. And it actually, I owe quite a bit to Peter for my work, because I had just returned from the field. My ideas were quite nebulous and unformed, and really a lot of the presentations I saw there and conversations helped shape my approach to thinking about calculation and carbon offsets. I'm not quite sure where to put this, so I just want to point out this talk is basically, if the talk seems a bit disjointed, that's because it's really a weaving together of three papers of mine. And these are the three papers. I was told, many of you have read this paper, I think, if that sounds right. This is the paper that Peter referenced. And there's a third paper, which I'll talk about part of it at the end, which is written with my colleagues, Kevin Grove and Jennifer Rice. And that's currently under review right now. So it's not. If anyone would like a copy of that top paper, I'm happy to share it. So generally in this talk, I wish to consider the practices and rationalities that allow for carbon management to become an economic problem. And I want to discuss the kinds of political and economic spaces that these practices create, that they reinforce and undermine. And I'll do so through my interpretation of three distinct efforts to render various spaces carbon neutral through the creation of a carbon offset. This first effort began in 2005 in an indigenous reserve in Costa Rica, there in southeast Costa Rica, when a 90-hectare block of former cattle pasture land was set aside to become a budding carbon-rich secondary forest. And through quite a bit of work and the ongoing efforts of scientists, government bureaucrats, Italian vacationers, and business owners, alongside various calculated devices such as GPS divines, signs, maps, and field reports, the carbon stored in this space can now be sold as a carbon offset on the internet through an Italian company called LifeGate. Here are some screenshots from that company. This is a so-called voluntary offset, where anyone could go to the internet, calculate their carbon footprint, much like I did for my talk earlier, and choose a piece of land in Costa Rica that could start store their carbon emissions. Since this time, a whole host of consumers have availed themselves of this forest to relieve their carbon sins. This website is great because it lists a whole host of companies and people that do this. So here's an Italian racer that has stored his carbon in this forest in Costa Rica. So race car drivers in Italy and fashion shows in Berlin can now store their carbon in this forest in Costa Rica. This offset territory, however, is in constant danger of becoming undone. Trees might be illegally removed from their site. Farmers might cut and plant a clandestine field of plantains. A fire might break out. Consumers might suspect this offset as a fraud. Therefore, once a year, the same group gets together to reiterate this carbon territory anew. Guided by GPS devices, they inspect the space's physical boundaries, they repair signs on the trees, they recut trails, and they take photographs at the site, all in the service of maintaining this precarious object of exchange, the carbon offset commodity. Okay. A second effort occurred around the same time and in roughly the same place, and a different yet very similar group of actors was trying to bring another carbon offset into being. This was a clean development mechanism offset. This offset's goal was to get farmers to switch from growing pesticide-intensive plantains on the left to return to a more traditional cacao agroforestry, organic cacao agroforestry system. So this project required significant technical work over a period of 2 years. Existing biomass was weighed and measured so that different types of land use can be assigned a standardized level of carbon storage. Economic analyses were performed to determine if a carbon offset can indeed produce this switch. Baseline and additionality calculations were performed that quantified the additional carbon stocks that would be sequestered over and above status quo forms of land use. After calculations were performed, however, project planners concluded that carbon can be efficiently sequestered not by promoting cacao agroforestry, but by paying farmers to abandon their subsistence slash and burn or swidden forms of agriculture. In other words, this project shifted its focus from encouraging one form of traditional agriculture to replacing another. So I'll talk a little bit more about why and how that came about. Finally, there's a third effort I briefly want to introduce, and this is an effort at accounting for carbon in the service of achieving neutrality. And this began in 1997 when the Costa Rican state introduced its Payments for Ecosystem Services program, which those of us that write about this get sick of writing it out all the time, so PES is pretty much what we've all agreed to call it. So this program has resulted in the Costa Rican state paying thousands of landowners not to cut down the forests of their land. And when they do so, the state receives the rights to, or the ownership rights over the carbon stored in that land. This has resulted in the state with many tons of carbon sequestration rights that it can now sell to international buyers as in the form of a carbon offset. Such sales, however, have been quite slow and have not met expectations. So in 2008, Costa Rican President Oscar Arias announced that Costa Rica will become a carbon neutral nation by 2021. Greenhouse gas emissions will still proceed, but such emissions will be neutralized through the purchase of a carbon offset from the state, which owns all of these carbon rights. In this way, the Costa Rican state is taking the element upon which all life depends, carbon, and is situating itself as the regulator of its flows, all in the hopes of securing its territorial space as climatically neutral. And it is doing so in a way that allows for carbon not only to be absorbed by trees, but by the economy as well. All right. So in this talk, I want to more closely consider these three examples of becoming carbon neutral and the kinds of spaces that they produce and also depend upon to come into being. And as these opening examples show, the creation of carbon offsets entail a number of practices that have the effect of creating spaces at various scales. So from the Cartesian spaces at the scale of a project to political efforts to transform the entire territory of Costa Rica into something that is carbon neutral. And along the way, I want to propose a couple of arguments concerning how and why carbon comes to be an economic object. That is, I will offer propositions that seek to explain the factors that encourage and sometimes disrupt the process of turning carbon into a commodity. So, to do that, let's start with this. So let's start with this. This is Marx's movement of the commodity form, right? You start with money, use that money, pay some people to make a commodity, you throw that commodity into the market and receive M prime, you receive more money, right? I would like to talk for a minute about the C, the actual commodity part, and its movement into M prime. This is a process of producing use values for exchange. So when the commodity is a pair of shoes, the use value of a shoe is fairly clear, right? Oh, yeah. So selling it as an alienable commodity is pretty straightforward. Sorry, my timing was a little off on that one. Now, when the C is nature, though, whether it's water or wetlands or trees or land or carbon, we're confronted with some confounding problems, and the commodification process seems to be a bit harder, not so straightforward. And a lot of folks have written on this, and here I want to challenge slightly a proposition that's found fairly frequently among geographers and other social scientists studying intersections of nature and capital. And the proposition goes something like this. Nature is irreducibly different from humans and unable to fully become part of the commodification process, or in other words, the qualities of nature disrupt the commodification process. This is a crude version of a Polanyian inflected argument where land is one of the three famous fictitious commodities because its properties render it so different that the commodification process cannot fully incorporate it. More nuanced versions of the somewhat straw man argument has been influential in understanding the neoliberalization of nature. So, for example, Karen Bakker has argued that water is, you have trouble turning water into a commodity in England because it is uncooperative, it's heavy, and has a quality of flows. That makes it difficult to commodify. Similarly, Scott Prudham has argued that trees are difficult commodities because they grow so slowly. It doesn't match the accumulation demands of capital, and therefore this requires particular alliances between capital, the state, and science to overcome this biophysical barrier to the commodification process. So this is also an idea that can be found throughout scholarship on agrarian change since at least Karl Kautsky. Agriculture, with its special spatial and temporal qualities, often resists its full incorporation into capitalism. So I'd like to offer a slightly different counterproposition. It is not the biophysical properties of nature that render its commodification so difficult. Instead, the value form is shot through with paradox and contradiction, and it is through the contradictions of the value form that nature comes to be enframed in ways that make it difficult to commodify. In other words, the emergence of nature as a commodity is stymied by the paradox of the value form itself. What is paradoxical and unstable about the value form? Well, let's talk about that. And consider the process of abstractions that are necessary to bring a carbon offset into being and how this relates to the value form. So as we all know, the process of commodification is one with a certain leveling effect, right? The abstractions of commodification necessarily renders many disparate landscapes the same. So with carbon offset trading, a primary forest in Uganda, a tree plantation in Ecuador, a wetland in India, all of these things become the same thing, right? X amount of carbon sequestration. These are abstract transformations that create the conditions of adequation that are necessary for the circulation of value, for things to be exchanged, right? It's a process common to all commodities. Carbon offsets, however, require more than abstractions for adequation. They also have a whole host of other calculative work. For instance, an offset usually involves extensive calculations that demonstrate additionality, that new carbon will be sequestered because of the sale of an offset. So for a forestry offset, you would basically calculate how much a farmer's land would sequester if you don't do the offset project, and you'd calculate how much it would sequester if you do, and the carbon you get to sell is what is over and above that baseline. Why do you have to do this? I argue that such calculations are needed not for exchange, but instead to render a carbon offset a useful thing so that value may ultimately be realized. Specifically, the need for such work is born out of what Marx calls the salto mortale of value. This is the idea that a commodity must make the leap from an exchange value to use value. Marx argues that at the point of production, a commodity is a potential use value for its non-owner, the potential consumer, and a potential exchange value for its owner, the producer. And for value to be realized, the commodity must change hands and become a real use value for the new owner and an exchange value for the producer. In other words, the producer of a commodity must produce use values for others for their commodities to eventually have value to be realized. However, a commodity only becomes a use value after it is sold and useful for the consumer of a commodity. So because of this, Marx argues, the producer must accept a leap of faith that the commodity will have a use value for someone, and that the value congealed in the commodity may ultimately be realized. And we can finally get to M prime in the chart. This abstract understanding of value has real consequences for a carbon offset. If a commodity must be useful, then it is fair to ask what it is useful for. Why is a clean development mechanism offset useful for, say, an owner of a power plant in Italy purchasing an offset? Is it the carbon in the ground that makes it useful? I argue, of course not. That carbon is thousands of miles away. It has of little use to the owner of a power plant. Instead, what makes a clean development mechanism offset useful is because it helps the owner of that power plant meet regulatory compliance. That's why that owner is buying an offset. And to help the owner of the power plant get under mandated emissions cuts that it cannot otherwise meet. It are the approved reports that certify that additional carbon is needed and that is indeed being sequestered that is useful for the owner of that power plant. In short, it is the representations of offsets that are useful in this context, not the actual carbon. So under the framework of Kyoto, for example, only existing documented additional carbon sequestering biomass can help that owner of a power plant meet regulatory compliance under the rules of Kyoto. Or to be more precise, only biomass that is demonstrated to be additional through particular cost-benefit procedures of land use change can meet this requirement. So a project may be de facto additional, it may be additional in the real world, but if it is not demonstrated to be such, then it is of no use to an offset consumer. This is the additionality criterion of the clean development mechanism, and it is critical for any regime of carbon regulation. If offset credits were to fund status quo projects or patterns of land use, then it would not be contributing to a net removal of carbon worldwide. So, for the owner of this power plant in Italy, an offset is not useful unless it is first shown to be useful in terms of demonstrated additionality. Or to put it in terms of the salto mortale, an offset must be put into an exchange relation before it can become useful for someone. However, this offset must be shown to be useful before it can be exchanged. Here, performing additionality calculations fill this role and help the salto mortale to be completed. Through these calculations, the commodity's usefulness and use value is demonstrated. The salto mortale of exchange can be completed, and value can be realized. So instead of calculations for exchange, you can read additionality calculations as calculations for usefulness. That is the calculations that make them useful. Oh, I'm sorry, here's a baseline. So such calculations can have serious consequences. These are some results of the additionality calculations of the project. They calculated the baseline level of how much carbon these indigenous farmers would sequester if they did nothing. And if they did their project, the top line is how much carbon would be calculated above it. Let's see here. If you recall, this project was supposed to replace plantain monocultures with cacao agroforestry. But once they did the cost-benefit calculations to prove that their project would indeed cause this change, they had to change their project. This is this x-axis is the rate of carbon fixation for different forms of land use. This is the net present value of different forms of land use. Basically, they found plantain is too valuable and relative to cacao and how much carbon is sequestered. The price of carbon is too low to make this switch. But when they did the calculations, they determined that fallow land has no value and it has a very high rate of carbon sequestration. So after they did these calculations, this became the more land use, attractive land use, not this. Note, there is nothing in this corner. That is, there is no land use that has high value and high rates of carbon sequestration. In this representation of the spaces of agriculture, I also note each agricultural space is considered atomistically as an absolute space that holds carbon. The project developers had very good reasons for doing this, because under the approved procedures of the clean development mechanisms, they had to make these comparisons in this way. But when they did so, the only space left for them to commodify was fallow land. I argue that this situation derives not from the inherent biophysical qualities of the plantain plant or the cacao tree, but instead it emerges through the requirements of the value form, the paradoxical and unstable position of the commodity before value is realized, and the need to relate the spaces of agriculture to carbon consumers, and both to a global circuit of atmospheric carbon. In other words, under the precarious choreography of the global carbon cycle that has come to define the Kyoto Protocol, it is not the carbon in the ground that gives an offset its use value. Instead, it is the relational ordering between the spaces of carbon storage, the carbon dioxide emitter, and the atmosphere itself that ultimately make a carbon offset useful. And under the overdetermined framework of carbon offset trading, additionality calculations become more than abstractions that represent an offset's use value, but rather the calculations are needed to demonstrate a project's usefulness and allow for the saltor mortale value to be completed. In this way, an offset's materialization becomes inseparable from its representations, and the calculations themselves become the useful thing. Okay. Part two. So here, I want to develop this argument a little bit more, but I want to do so by, I want to talk about how difficult it is to make a carbon offset. I don't want to imply that these sorts of spaces are ready to receive carbon, that they're easy to produce. In fact, they're quite unstable themselves, and they need to be continually reasserted in ways that require precarious ensembles of scientists, bureaucrats, landowners, machines, signs, fences. In short, there is a lived socio-technical performance that the value form demands, one that is rife with instabilities and potential moments of the offset's undoing. So to flesh out what I mean by this, let's return to the first carbon offset I introduced, the voluntary one involving the Italian company LifeGate. I want to consider for a moment the role of calculative devices themselves in this process and the kinds of spaces they require and exclude. This carbon verification trip that I described earlier, I accompanied this group. And on this trip, we circled the borders of this carbon territory in order to document that it basically was still there. They do this once a year. And our trip itself was heavily dependent on GPS devices to guide our walk. During our walk, someone would yell out a GPS waypoint. One of the female volunteers would write it down and maybe a tree species that we saw. Someone else would take a photo. All of this documentation was going into a report to show the investor of this offset that it really was sequestering carbon and that it actually still existed. Well, at one point, instead of trees, we encountered a plantain field. And upon encountering this field, government technicians and NGO volunteers immediately began examining their GPS devices. And within a few minutes, everyone with a device concluded that we were standing in an unauthorized plantain field. Well, with our group was the president of the Quebecer Indigenous Reserve, like the leader of the reserve. And he disputed this consensus. And what began was a long and tense conversation between the president of the Indigenous Reserve, the head of this Italian NGO that was leading our group, and the government employees, and they began arguing over where the border of this space really was. The indigenous president, he pointed to a nearby tree and he made a sweeping motion with his arm. He said, "The border goes from that tree over there to the river over there. The plantains are outside of the area." He was very angry about this. The NGO leader, however, stood next to him, pulled out his GPS device, pointed at the map, and he said, "Look at this. This is where we are, and we're standing inside a plantain field." So at first, the president held his ground, insisting that his border, defined by his imaginary line from the tree to the river, was the border of the carbon offset and rendered the plantain field outside of the territory. Soon, others in the group returned from a reconnaissance mission, and they pointed to their GPS devices, shouting, "It's plantains all the way over there." Finally, after a few more tense minutes of arguing, the indigenous president realized he was outnumbered and he gave up. He agreed to cut down the plantains at his expense. He apologized. And that was that. However, later that evening, one of the government technicians discovered that he downloaded the digital maps onto his GPS devices using the wrong projection. And in fact, the indigenous president was correct. And many of those plantains really were outside of the carbon reserve after all. So, this is one of those beautiful moments when you're doing your field work and you're like, "I can't believe that actually happened. That'll make my dissertation for sure." So, here I am, 5 years later, still telling that story. It's a great story because it brings up the question, why didn't the indigenous president's border count? Why didn't his space count? Why didn't they listen to him? He was right, right? So, to understand this, I wish to ground this encounter a little bit in Judith Butler's ideas about the abject. For Butler, the materiality of the body has no a priori ontology. Instead, it's emergent as an effective power. This materialization of the body is the result of practices that circumscribe the domain of intelligibility, where the body becomes viable through continual iterative performances. So, under this philosophy, entities like the body or nature are not socially constructed, because this is a term that implies someone is doing the constructing. Instead, these entities become materialized in particular ways through iterative daily bodily practices, practices that take on these forms to become legible. Butler was concerned with sex. I'm concerned with nature. Butler argues that this performative materialization necessarily entails a relation to that which cannot fall within the domain of intelligibility, what she calls the abject. Here, the abject is not just the opposite of the material norms that a discursive material performance opens, but it is the excluded and unintelligible outside to the regulatory norms that are continually materialized. Butler argues that the power effects of bodily norms derive in part from the possibility of their destabilization, where the abject represents such possibilities, ultimately allowing for the normative effects of bodily materializations to emerge. Okay, so this, let's talk about this abstract idea in terms of carbon offsets. I argue here, it's useful to think of the indigenous president's space, the one crystallized by his sweeping hand, as an abject one. The ability of his sweeping hand to conjure in an intelligible space with our group was ineffectual and unviable so long as it remained unarticulated with the spatial abstractions of the GPS devices that everyone else was holding. Here, the only viable spaces are those that are performed within a dual movement between the abstract and the material, the bodily movement of the human and the representations of space by the GPS system. The joining together of these two forms is what brings the space into being as a site of carbon storage, a permanent, absolute space that is understood in relation to a global space of the climate, a space that allows for a consumer in Italy to equate the actions of their own body to a patch of land somewhere in Costa Rica through the purchase of a commodity. This was the space we were performing, a use value for exchange. The concrete directionality of the indigenous president's hand gesture failed to have an effect among our group, not because it was inaccurate, but rather, the president's boundary was untenable within the context of our group's performance. His performance, however, had effects in other ways. Its very abjectness enabled the technology-mediated space of our group to emerge as a fulfillment of a norm. The president's space is just what a carbon offset can never be. It was accurate, but not precise. It was easily understandable, but outside of a globally mediated spatial frame. The president's performance of space, as it occurred alongside those with the GPS devices, served to reinforce the global, absolute space that was the norm that was necessary for this commodity to become into being. While the president knew where the border was, his failure to relay his border to a technologically mediated global context reinforced the need for our group's work, which in turn served to materialize this particular relation between local and global space. So the president's border eventually did find expression within this context, but not until later that evening, when the GIS technician cross-checked the tree in question, cross-checked what they were doing to the maps on his computer. Here, the accuracy of the president's space did not undermine the commodified space of this offset. Instead, it was the opposite. His space finally became acceptable once it was articulated with the technologies of our group's GPS maps. So in the end, the president's space did not undermine the performance of our transsex walk, but instead it further reiterated its power. Okay, final section. And here, I want to zoom out a little bit. This is based on publication I did a while back, and it's under review along with some colleagues. I want to zoom out a little, away from the intimate moments of an offset's becoming to the scale of the nation state. And I want to consider the Costa Rican state's intention to become a carbon neutral territory. And what I want to do is I want to show how this idea, at least briefly, arose through often unconnected governmental practices related to resource security. And doing so, I want to argue that it is not the diffusion, the rise of carbon offsetting in Costa Rica is not the diffusion of some global policy idea to Costa Rica, although that certainly plays a part, but instead, well, here is my second proposition. Instead, I wish to argue that carbon neutrality, as is practiced in Costa Rica, has its origins in a much wider governmental project, that is, achieving environmental security through economic circulation. So, to make this argument, I want to consider the rationalities of the country's ecosystem service payment program. PES is how Costa Rica intends to become carbon neutral, by allowing domestic carbon emitters to offset their carbon sins through by buying offsets from the government. Since 1997, the state has been making payments to farmers to not cut down their trees. When it does so, it basically works like this. The state makes a payment to the landowner, and that payment means the landowner is transferring the rights to that, to all those trees' carbon to the state. The state is basically buying not just carbon rights, but actually biodiversity rights, scenic beauty. There's four values they say they're buying, so they could, in theory, sell biodiversity offsets if they wanted to as well. So when they make this, has left the state with many tons of carbon offsets that it can do, that it can sell if it wants. Okay. My contention is that this plan, where the nation's forests have become sites of carbon storage to be bought and sold, has its origins in the 1980s. This was a time in Costa Rica where the country was suffering through basically three crises. It had a major foreign debt crisis and was suffering through three rounds of painful structural adjustment policies. In the 1980s, it was suffering through an ecological crisis. In the 1980s, Costa Rica had the highest rate of deforestation in the world. High rates of deforestation in the 1970s and 1980s. And finally, there was a geopolitical crisis because the United States was pressuring Costa Rica to allow it to conduct its war with Honduras to the north. This was during the time of the Contra Sandinista War, and so there was all sorts of pressure for Costa Rica to become militarized. It's quite famously a country without a military, the only one in Central America. So these crises gave rise to a number of things, but two things I'll talk about today. These two things here. Two things that later catalyzed the emergence of PES. One is practices of financialization, specifically financialization in environmental governance, and two, the development of geospatial technologies for tracking the forest. Neither of these developments initially had anything to do with carbon offsets, but were grounded in these crises, emerged out of these crises I just briefly described. Eventually, however, they came to structure the rise of PES policy in important ways. So, sorry, this is a lot of text. My reference to financialization here is to a process of ordering social and ecological relations around rationalities derived from financial speculation. Specifically, I'll talk in a minute about techniques of securitization and leverage. Securitization is basically the creation of financial products such as derivatives out of place-specific risks, debts, or assets. And market actors can take on securitized risks, and this allows them to exert greater control over resources or processes that they would be able to influence otherwise. I'll give a concrete example of this in a minute. During Costa Rica's debt crisis in the 1980s, this began to occur with the rise for debt-for-nature swaps, which I will discuss here as a way to illustrate how the discursive logics of financialization became embedded as a governmental technique and later came to shape the rise of ecosystem services. So, briefly, debt-for-nature swaps began in the early 1980s when large conservation organizations began to be very concerned about deforestation. This was about the time many countries in Latin America were going through a debt crisis. They could not pay their foreign debt. So the idea was that conservation organizations could leverage a developing country's debt to raise funding for conservation. So basically what happens is, in a debt-for-nature swap, a country's discounted debt is purchased on a secondary market and then exchanged with that country with the agreement for, they'll cancel the debt, basically, if that country agrees to increase funding for conservation. So,
oh, I have it on there,
yeah. So, in 1988, the World Wildlife Fund bought $5.4 million of debt for $891,000 on the secondary market. And it exchanged that debt with the government of Costa Rica, and with the agreement, the government of Costa Rica would pay $4 million, roughly, in conservation investments. So, government of Costa Rica has $5.4 million of debt canceled for $4 million, but the World Wildlife Fund gets to see $4 million spent on conservation for a mere $891,000. This is like leveraging debt, right? Here, I want to note that through this mechanism, nature itself is not swapped. Such swaps rarely involve the purchase of land. Instead, what the government of Costa Rica exchanges for debt relief is the agreement to fund increased enforcement and management of its already existing conservation areas. The point of the swaps, therefore, is to leverage money toward the enforcement of already existing laws. So in this way, you could consider that it is governance itself that is swapped for debt relief. So such swaps are driven by a rationality of environmental governance that binds locally specific forms of environmental security to globalized forms of finance. And you can see signs of this rationality today in Costa Rica's PES program. At the heart of its PES program lies a paradox. Farmers are paid by the government to not cut down their forests, yet it is illegal to cut down your forest. The same law that brought into being PES also makes the felling of forests illegal. You can cut some trees, but it requires a management plan. It's very complicated. You can't just go cut your forest. It's illegal to. So in this way, landowners are being paid to do what the law should already compel them to do. So yeah, that seems crazy, right? What's going on? Well, what to make of that? I say that this seemingly redundant existence of both prohibitions and incentives occupy two different forms of governmental rationalities, each with its own spatiality and modes of promoting security. The law against cutting trees exists as a diffusion of order across the nation's territory, in which the forest is to be secured through legally enforceable prohibitions. At the same time, is a slightly different governmental logic of securing the forest through leveraging flows of currency to compel actors to act in their own rational interest. A more neoliberal rationality, I guess you could call it. And these are coincident rationalities that are, I argue, dependent upon each other. The law prohibiting felling trees is now enforceable through the state's connections with flows of currency, debt, and global capital. So debt-for-nature swaps were an early instance of this linkage between security and circulation in environmental governance, where securing the forest means linking it to flows of finance as a means to ensure that the force of law has its intended effects. Where the government pays you to do what the law says, where the government is being paid to do what the law says it should do already. Through this early program, financial flows became tied to the law, and as a result, it bound governmental concerns with security and circulation through debt for nature swaps. And now today, the same rationality pervades the development of PES. Okay. This process has its origins in rationalities of... debt for nature swaps were part of the introduction of financialization of environmental governance. But there were also the emergence of geospatial technologies that allowed the nation's forests to become understood as flows of carbon. I briefly want to talk about how the rise of the use of GIS helped lead to carbon offsetting. This process had its origins in the rationalities of securing the forest as well. In 1986, in response to the nation's high deforestation rates, the Costa Rican government mandated that any landowner that wants to cut down a tree needs to undertake a forest management plan. These plans were widely regarded as burdensome, confusing, very expensive, and they were widely ignored. And that law largely failed to halt deforestation. However, in 1989, a non-governmental organization named FundeCor was formed through USAID, United States Agency for International Development Financing. And its goal was to increase forest cover by encouraging landowners to see their forests as potential sources of annual income. And its strategy for doing this was to take on the burden of developing these onerous state-mandated management plans. And the idea was that instead of illegal deforestation, farmers would undertake sustainable and profitable thinnings of their forest stands. They would never cut down the whole forest, just do sustainable thinnings. And one of FundeCor's initial problems was to identify exactly where to focus its resources, which farmers to work with. And because FundeCor had all of this USAID money, they had some of the most sophisticated GIS systems in the entire country. And so they were able to use various variables like population pressure, prior existence of permits, distance from roads, and put that all into a GIS and develop a sophisticated map for where they're going to work. Then use these spatial targets to determine which landowners it should assist in developing these management plans. Well, interestingly, having these data in a GIS catalyzed a series of epistemic shifts for FundeCor and how it came to understand forestry interventions, until a few years later, it started selling carbon offsets. First, when it had all its forestry management plans in a GIS system, FundeCor realized it could easily predict future forest harvests from a whole range of farmers. So it began selling these future forests as a futures contract and giving these farmers an advance payment for their forests. So it started getting into the business of selling forest futures. After having some success with this, FundeCor then began combining their data with previously produced maps on forest growth rates and carbon sequestration rates that other scientists were working on. Soon, not only did they have futures contracts for forest thinnings, but they had data on how much carbon was being sequestered because of their efforts. This, to make a long story short, led to them selling the country's first carbon offset to the government of Norway in the mid-1990s. At this time, the sale of this offset, the head of Costa Rica's Environment Ministry seized on what he called the scientific certainty of FundeCor's work. And he pointed to the organization's success at creating an offset as the new direction the state must go. And FundeCor's exacting spatial calculations and his subsequent support from the Environment Minister helped to establish the concept of carbon sequestration payments as a cornerstone of the country's new forest policy. So to make another long story very short, FundeCor's work and initial success became the model for what would later become payments for ecosystem services in Costa Rica. Okay, so what this empirical story shows is that in many ways it was the use and the calculations of GIS that helped lead to the work of carbon offsetting and not the other way around. They didn't start with the idea of carbon offsets and come up with technologies. They started putting data in a GIS and realized more and more what they could do with it, and it led to carbon offsetting. In short, diverse forms of calculation and assessment became powerful forms of economization in their own right. That is, the forest became a carbon commodity through the application of various geospatial technologies for other ends, but eventually these modes of framing the forest coalesced in ways that allowed for the forest to emerge as potential sites of carbon sequestration.
I'm not keeping up with my slides.
What ultimately allowed this to happen, I argue, were diverse ways of dealing with the issue of security through the encouragement of circulation. The high deforestation rates from previous decades brought the security of the nation's forest resources to the forefront. These modes of financial and environmental insecurities eventually resulted in the introduction of financialized logics into forest management through debt for nature swaps and later the work of Fundecor. In these cases, the problem of natural resource security called for landowners to see their trees as potential exports to be properly managed, and for better environmental governance to be leveraged through the global debt market. This entwining of security and circulation is not contradictory, but rather what modern liberal forms of security have become. As Michel Foucault details through the example of town planning in the 18th century, security is a matter of enabling circulation between a territory and its surroundings. The point of security, therefore, is not to prevent the unexpected, but instead to allow events to unfold in a way that maximizes the transactional economy of social and ecological circulation. So, in Costa Rica today, practices of securing circulation have resulted in a volumetric securing of territory in which the soils, people, machinery, and the atmosphere are stitched together through their relation to carbon. Greenhouse gases have now become a point of governmental inclusion, territorialized by the Costa Rican nation state through the financialized logics of the commodity. This is a process of securing terrestrial and atmospheric carbon that is in some ways radically new, but at the same time, it is grounded in a history of accounting for the nation's resources that has been unfolding for some time. Once the nation's forest resources began to be linked with trade and debt, they became defined in new ways. Debt became leveraged into better management of nature, and forests became calculable stocks of carbon. Now, with the country's Neutrality 2021 plan, such stocks are being linked to the governmental project of securing the circulation of the country's carbon through its emergence as an economic object.
Not keeping up with my slides, sorry.
Okay, very briefly, I wish to conclude this talk by noting all three of these efforts to become neutral are in some ways failures. The first example I gave was of a clean development mechanism effort that actually never got off the ground. They never made it, never got past the scoping stage. In fact, clean development mechanism forestry offsets are notoriously few because the practices of calculating the forest are so difficult. The second effort, the voluntary offset, was a successful offset, but it was fraught with small failures and difficulties, as I described. And finally, no one seriously thinks that Costa Rica will become carbon neutral by 2021. Even with this offsetting plan. In fact, carbon emissions in the country have only gone up since President Arias's announcement. So, while Costa Rica's plan for carbon neutrality will likely fail, its rise as a political technology has been a tremendous success. You can see a parallel, actually, in Costa Rica's experience with the World Bank's structural adjustment policies. Those policies were failures as well. Costa Rica's debt burden has gotten worse ever since structural adjustment, is higher than ever. Yet, the World Bank's prescriptions for the economy were resounding successes in other ways. Structural adjustment policies decidedly shifted the political terrain of what policies are possible. They unwound decades of state infrastructure and reoriented the politics of Costa Rica towards an openness to increased global capital flows. Similarly, if we think of carbon neutrality not as a technical condition to be achieved, but as a political technology, we can more properly diagnose its effects. Becoming neutral is a process that reinforces rather than undermines the political space of Costa Rica. Carbon becomes not an international problem, but one that can be dealt with inside the nation state. At the same time, becoming neutral further welds environmental governance to ongoing financial flows, where trees are resources to be leveraged for particular forms of governance, not conserved. This is a rationality toward nature that can now be extended to the environmental subject of citizen consumers, where all Costa Ricans will need to think more closely about their actions in terms of carbon equivalencies and link them to the commodified carbon sink. These kind of effects are unfinished projects and as such allow for possible potential subversion of the current carbon governance regime. Understanding how such subversion may come about is beyond the scope of this talk, fortunately for me, but I suggest that a first step towards resisting this regime of carbon offsets is in recognizing how and why it has come to be. So, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for what I would say was a really dense talk. Many issues connected from very different levels, and at least for me, a lot of things still to think about. But I suppose many of you have questions.
We're talking about carbon sequestration payments in Costa Rica. You were talking about everything that goes around these carbon sequestration payments, and all is directed and focused in Costa Rica.
Yeah.
Only last week there was a report on the carbon offsetting policy in the EU, and obviously it's not working at all.
Yeah, sure.
So I wonder. What this means for your project and for your perspective on Costa Rica. Do you think that this kind of financialization of nature is going on also? This offsetting doesn't work any longer? There are no payments because all of these exemptions?
Yeah.
Or will it stop all these efforts?
Okay, good question. Well, I think, yes, I agree. I mean, if you are concerned with climate change, reducing carbon in the air, which is what this is supposed to do, offsets don't really work. They don't. But
they don't even work as financial payments. You know, nobody's paying the money.
Oh, I see what you mean. Like the market for this is just like collapsing. Or yes. Whatever. Is that what you mean? Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Well, actually, what I found interesting about doing this, the last part of this talk, was trying to trace sort of disconnected rationalities that later led into offsetting. It lets me think about offsetting as something that will eventually fail and go away. So like the same thing has more or less happened with debt for nature swaps. At the time, in the 80s, this was seen as this like great idea in which the debt burden of countries will be reduced, we'll stop all this deforestation. It's like the classic win-win scenario you're always hearing about, right? But that kind of fizzled away and didn't work either, right? But then, I guess what I'm trying to argue here is it kind of became something else, right? People started linking debt and payments to just obeying the law, right? Which later came to infuse PES. So I think what I'm interested in the future is if offsets collapse, I think this kind of rationality of thinking about forests and consumers as like being tied somehow and linked together, it will evolve in ways maybe we're unexpected ways that we don't know, right? And so it doesn't end my project, actually. It will probably make things more interesting in the future. But what that will be, it's hard to say, right? Okay, good question.
I had a question. I'm going to bring it back a more political perspective on the whole project. And how far is it, a empirical question, how far are these projects discussed in the Costa Rican public as a project, as a project of global governance, as an interference in internal affairs, as a problem for national autonomy and so on? Is it framed as such? I mean, for me, very convincingly, are framing it as a new idea, a new concept of global governance. And I was just thinking Frankfurt is on its way, you know, becoming neutral in 2030, and they're working on a master plan, energy for Frankfurt 2050, with the aim of becoming carbon neutral. So I think bits and pieces of instruments, ways of calculation, you know, are circulating around, which even more gives the impression that it is a emerging global system of governance, but is it framed as such in the public?
I guess it depends on who you ask. Mm-hmm. As far as among policymakers and whatnot, it gets framed differently by different policymakers. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to offsets, it's still very much planned and talked about as national level plans. So maybe you've heard about like RED readiness. I don't know if y'all know what RED is, like reducing emissions through preventing deforestation and degradation. Mm-hmm. Every country has a RED readiness plan. Right? Mm-hmm. This is very much done at the scale of the country. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And among many political geographers, there's a lot of talk about how climate change is such a complex global international problem that the nation state is no longer, you cannot solve these problems through the nation state, right? So you see the emergence of like network coalitions of cities coming together to fight climate change, or regional coalitions of actors, or global coalitions of actors, and the state just plays a minor role in, or it's just one of many actors trying to govern something so global, right? But that argument is fine, and there's quite a bit of political geographers that have made that argument. But my experience with carbon offsets is the opposite, actually. In many ways, it strengthens the scale of the nation state. And mm-hmm. you see many states emerging like this plan for neutrality. Mm-hmm. They're strengthening the territoriality of the state as a space that we need to control as carbon offset, right? And it's not really even dealing with flows from other places and whatnot. So I think it's this weird sort of double-edged process where it's obviously this global process where you see the emergence of new types of political formations. But at the same time, you see things rise like carbon neutrality in Costa Rica, where they're reinforcing their territorial space through offsetting. So that'd be my answer. A little bit of both. Mm-hmm.
Some more questions which might have come up in the seminar this week and last week.
One question. You mentioned the carbon offsets. I wondered who are buying those offsets. You mentioned the Norwegian government, but and you also talked about to get rid of carbon sins, uh-huh. which should have a kind of appeal to the consciousness of ordinary people.
Yeah. Great question. The number one purchaser of carbon offsets is, do you want to guess? It's the World Bank. The World Bank is buying most of the carbon offsets out there, and that is certainly the case for Costa Rica. They have started what is known as the Biocarbon Fund, in which they purchase a bunch of carbon offsets simply to purchase them so they can be made. The whole idea is it's like priming the pump. You have that expression or know that expression, right? Like, World Bank doesn't need a carbon offset. It doesn't want carbon offsets. What the World Bank wants is a market for carbon offsets, right? So the idea is if they just keep buying these offsets, it will encourage Costa Rica to continue to try and produce these offsets, try and get the supply going, right? So like right now, this Payments for Ecosystem Services program in the country, it's financed through a gas tax. About half of it is financed through a gas tax. The other half is financed basically by World Bank loans. And so that's buying it. So that goes back to your question about this thing collapsing. It's thus far, there. Whatever market there is really kind of a fake one, I guess you could call it. Good question. Yes?
Would you say that the reason for the market not working is because there's no natural use value to the carbon offset, so there's really no feasible way which the market will work? Is that right now it's a fake market, but is there even a way it could not be a fake market?
Well, sure. I mean, as I my argument in the first part of this talk is like when you buy the offset, what is useful is not the tree in Costa Rica, but that piece of paper, right, that says so many tons, and so you can continue to emit carbon without having to do anything about it, right? Yeah. That's what it's this piece of paper. But that is underpinned by some sort of regime of regulation, right? So, yes, there would be a way for there to be a market. Basically, I mean, if you look at the history of offsetting, the biggest problem was that the United States never bought into this whole thing. So when many of these plans were being formulated in the 90s in Costa Rica, so they had all these grand plans of selling offsets at a high price because they assumed, I don't know why they would assume this, because kind of a silly assumption that the United States would ratify the Kyoto Protocol and move on to the Clean Development Mechanism offset. Well, I mean, you know anything about U.S. politics. The United States rarely ratifies any of the agreements that they signed, so I don't know what made them think that the U.S. would ratify Kyoto. But the idea was that the U.S. would be this huge buyer of it, right? And that would have created this big market. That never happened. And so you see this PES program where the state had all these plans of selling offsets, but now they have no one to buy these offsets. So, yeah, it could happen, but it would have to be underpinned by a collective agreement to seriously curb carbon emissions and allow these offsets to happen.
There would need to be a price to be assigned to the carbon emissions, but assigning that price from the top would kind of be artificial and make it a fake market?
Well, I would say the price could be determined through how stringent the regulation is. Like, let's say there's a regulation that says you must reduce your emissions by 90%, but you can make that up by buying offsets. Well, all of a sudden, you would see the price of carbon offsets start to go up, right? But right now, there's all sorts of loopholes to get around these regulations. Big carbon emitters like the United States and China don't have these types of regulations, so the price is just really low. And there's a lot of suppliers, too, so that would be my answer.
More questions? Thank you a lot.
Okay.
Thanks again for the presentation. Everybody is invited to join us to Taboo, which is quite over there. Greenwich has 900 meters, 12 minutes to walk, so it is not far. Please come and continue to talk today. Thanks.